Welcome to the History Hotline, a direct line to a better understanding of all things Black history and beyond. Everyone, and welcome to episode 144 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and as always, I will be your host today. Today's episode is going to be something I haven't done for a while, actually. Some book recommendations. Now, I feel like I insert books in every now and again to episodes and articles and things to read to stay informed and to keep up with the topic that we're speaking about. But on today's episode, I thought I'd talk you through some of the things I'm reading at the moment. I'm always reading multiple things at once. I have a really bad habit of doing that, but also actually just doing history in an academic setting and, you know, doing a PhD and working on research and like researching different things, sometimes within similar themes or similar topics or the subject matter being the same. But it typically tends to be the case that I'm reading a few things at once, and there's no exception at this moment in time. So I thought I'd share with you four books, but there's a fifth book I wanted to talk about, even though it has absolutely nothing to do with Black British history or history more broadly. It's actually dystopian, so the complete opposite period of time that I like to spend, you know, my thoughts with. I kind of felt like I needed five, because five is kind of like a round number. I don't know, people do top fives, they don't really do top fours. Maybe we should start top fours. Top fours make sense. If there's only four, then it should be a top four. But there's a top four that are all on theme. And then the fifth book we'll get to at the end is dystopian. And you'll understand when I get to it why I can't put the book down, actually. It's a fiction book as well. It'd be the only fiction book on the list. I don't typically read a lot of fiction. I'm trying to read more of it because it's actually just fun. It's nice. It's interesting. But having done an English degree, I have a bit of a distant relationship with reading fiction for fun now, because I spent 3 years deeply analysing fiction and reading texts that typically I would have read for fun, because I did modules on things like Black British literature, African American literature, post-colonial literature, things that I would probably read for fun anyway, but I read them in an academic setting and wrote essays about them and applied theory to them, and then they just lost the fun. The fun was sapped out of reading for pleasure. But I'm getting back to that point where I can read for pleasure, and if you're in a similar place, then I think you need to read books that are kind of not easy reads per se, but really like gripping storylines to get you back into the habit of reading for fun, especially. And the book that I'm going to talk about, this is quite the build up for this book at the end. When I get there anyway, you'll maybe understand why. Great book. But I'm going to start with book number one. Also, none of these books, two of them are recent releases. By recent, I mean in the last few months. The other ones are older and have been around. But, you know, the great thing about books is that it's not like social media or like a YouTube video or content that comes out now that seems to be kind of has to be consumed in the moment. It has to be understood within the current context that we're situated in, we're living in. A book can sit on a shelf for years, for decades, or the best books anyway, can sit on a shelf and still be relevant, whether you're reading it within the context that you're living in and applying things, or you're understanding it in the context that it was written in to know and glean more information about that time. That is the beauty of books. But we're going to start with book number one, and that is Gus Johns' Blazing Trails, Stories of a Heroic Generation. And the preface is by Margaret Busby. I always wonder, is it preface or preface? Both of them sound great. Preface, then preface. I don't know. I think it's preface. I think I've heard people say preface, but preface sounds better to me. published in 2023 by New Beacon Books. I actually bought it at New Beacon Books last year, 2023. And it has been on my shelf. I've read sections of it, but not all of it. But it essentially, you know, talks us through these stories of a, quote, heroic generation, and in different kind of professions, and it's split up into sections. So part one is on publishing and media, part two is on performance, three is on education, and the education section is stacked, which, much to my delight, considering my PhD topic. Part four is health work, part five is social work, and part six is community and rights activism. And for the most part, they're names of people that I actually, like, haven't come across in the study of Black British history and within the study of these kinds of specific areas. There are obviously, you know, the more popular names like John LaRose, Jessica Huntley, Molly Hunt. And I say Molly Hunt because I actually recorded an episode with Rebecca Adams, who's an archivist. And that episode will be coming out soon, if not next week, the week after, where we discuss Molly Hunt actually in depth, which is really nice actually, because she's an educational psychologist in Britain. One of the first Black educational psychologists, if not the first. And actually is one of those people that I think is quite underserved and their story is quite unknown. Historically, archivally, they have a presence in the archive that has allowed for a lot of work to be done on them. But I think there is still a lot of work to be done, and also can help with our understanding of education and the ways in which Black people are having to overcome the injustice in the education system. And it's just a really nice selection of people. I'll go through some of the other people that you may or may not have heard of before. In the publishing and media section, there is John LaRose, Jessica Huntley, and Milverton Wallace. There is Pearl Connor, Geraldine Connor, Jane Cortez, and Cy Grant in the performance section. Education, Winston Bess, Trevor Carter, Tina Sylvester, Molly Hunt, Peter Figuero, Hewlett Andrew, also known as Huey, Victoria Joseph, Jean Edwards, June Baden-Semper, and social work with Willis Wilkie, John Small. I say with, they're not writing, it's about them. And interestingly, and one of the things I like about the book is that Gustron uses kind of different forms of media to tell their story and to kind of get into their life, whether it's kind of eulogies, whether it's blog posts he's written, it's documents, it's interviews, in order to tell their stories. And part six, the community and rights activism section, features the stories of Ruby Innes, Pansy Jeffrey, Joan Campbell, and Ian MacDonald. And then there is an afterword by Gus John. I think this book would actually be perfect for teachers. For example, if, you know, Black History Month is fast approaching and you want to educate students or, you know, yourself on people that aren't necessarily, their names aren't always called when we think about Black British history. These are the stories of people that have worked to make Britain a better and a more equitable place for Black people without necessarily the applause, without necessarily kind of being a big name. And in this kind of time where we are, I like to think, getting better at Black British history and understanding some of the people that have done incredible things, their names still are left off. So, you know, if you are thinking about doing assemblies, form time slots, I think it's a great text to arm yourself with, because, you know, it's not the typical list of people. And they're working in industries, and the ones I mentioned, that I don't like to use the word ordinary, but are ordinary. And I think it's important that we think about, you know, the people that were making education better, that were making, you know, activism a better place, that were making publishing more equitable. They are important stories as well. The sections are, you know, informative, but also quite concise, could be shared, could be read, you know, read out in assemblies, in form time, as I said, in lessons. And it makes for a great selection of individuals to be centred in this text. The next book I wanted to talk about is Kieran Connell's Multicultural Britain, A People's History. Now, I haven't finished this book yet. I am partway through, and I'm really enjoying it so far. It starts off with Kieran Connell kind of centering the story of a multicultural Briton through his own upbringing in Balsall Heath, which is in Birmingham, and his kind of experiences in school in what is described as a really racially diverse school. Balsall Heath being an area of a lot of post-war migration into the 70s and 80s, and it kind of is set around this period. I say set, it's not story per se, it's definitely a non-fiction text, but the way that it kind of starts with this story, I won't spoil it. It sounds weird to say you won't spoil a non-fiction book when it's like historical, but it anecdotally sets the scene for us to get into this kind of moment in the 1980s. The text runs through the 1940s to the 1990s, and it moves around Britain, starting 1940s Cardiff, thinking about brown babies, colour bars in 1950s Nottingham, red lights in 1960s Balsall Heath, black powers in 1980s Bradford, and white flights in 1990s Balsall Heath. And they are the five chapters that it centres on. And it kind of frames multiculturalism as, and like multi-racial Britain, or multi-racialism, if that could be a term, as a kind of transitional stage as opposed to anything fixed, not like a fixed moment where we can identify Britain as being multicultural, but this ever-changing not tension per se, but this kind of ever-changing movement of people and mixing of different cultural groups in Britain, and what that kind of means, and how what that looks like and how it functions within British society. One of the questions that Kieran Connell poses, which I'm quite excited to kind of get into, is what kinds of politics emerged out of multicultural communities as ethnic diversity increased and the needs of particular groups, including the growing number of ethnic minorities born in Britain, changed over time. I'm really interested in the way that generational differences and the way when a generation, you know, a kind of generation moves out or grows up and a new generation is born, especially when they're born in Britain, to parents that were not, you know, what are their needs? What are their politics? What, as Kieran Connell is asking, you know, what are the politics that are emerging out of, say, the children of Caribbean migrants that were born in Britain in the 60s or 70s, the children of Indian parents born in India, and the children being born in the 80s, say, or the 90s in Britain. What, you know, what are the politics that are emerging? What are the kind of identifying factors? How are they identifying themselves in relation to their ethnicity, the places of their parents or grandparents' birth compared to Britain, where they now live, are born and raised? What about, you know, within my own work, thinking about children that migrate, how do they see themselves in relation to home in comparison to the place that they're now being raised in? As Kieran Connell is probing, you know, what, as this kind of diversity increases, and not only just diversity of different groups of people arriving in Britain, but actually diversity by way of having completely different senses of self in comparison to one another across generations, second, third generation, you know, the way in which that they are perceiving themselves and others, not just in relation to the kind of white British population, but also in relation to each other, black people, Asian people, and obviously they're overarching labels, but, you know, Jamaican children compared to Nigerian, you know, immigrants that have moved and, you know, they are coming as immigrants and not necessarily claiming Britain, in comparison to Pakistani children that have been born and raised in Britain, you know, all these kind of differences by way of being ethnically diverse. how they are functioning within multicultural Britain. All very interesting. Book number three is Colin Douglas's The Caribbean and the Second World War. And if you're thinking, that sounds familiar, Colin Douglas sounds familiar, this book sounds familiar, then you would be right, because every week for probably the last 4 weeks, I've been promoting the next live show at the Imperial War Museum on the 19th of October at 4 p.m. And it will be in conversation with the one and only Colin Douglas about his book, The Caribbean and the Second World War. So it's a good thing that I've read it, as we will be discussing it at length and the wider context of Caribbean military histories. You know, if Black British history is your thing, this is the event for you. If military history is your thing, this is also the event for you. And, you know, if the history hotline is your thing, this is also the event for you. There will be more information in the show notes, but tickets are available on the Imperial War Museum website. I believe tickets are £10 and there are concession prices available as well. And it will be a 45-minute show from 4 p.m. on the 19th of October, 2024. But if you're thinking, will I like this book? Do I want to hear from Mr. Colin Douglas and Deanna Lindcook as they talk about the Caribbean and the Second World War? Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the book. Maybe this will help you make up your mind. I will firstly say, just for context, as I do, Colin Douglas also wrote a book called West Indian Women at War, British Racism in World War II, with Ben Bousquet. So that was a co-authored book. And that book saved my bacon. To say the very least, it saved my master's dissertation. Because for some reason, when I went to the archives, the Black Cultural Archives, I think it was about January 2020. My dissertation was due August 2020. And it might have even been December 2019, actually, now I think about it. I went there to look at anything relating to Caribbean women and their migration to Britain, because that's what the master's dissertation was going to be all about. And I stumbled upon this book in the BCA library. And I started reading it. And I couldn't put it down. And I think I read, if not all of it, like 90% of it, as well as going through some other archival oral history interviews from the Black Women's Movement that are held at the BCA. And I was engrossed. I was obsessed. I was like, wow, I did not know that West Indian women were part of the war effort. Didn't know that they joined the Auxiliary Territorial Service. I didn't know that they were stationed in Britain, in the US, and in the Caribbean. I didn't know it was the same armed force that Queen Elizabeth, then Princess Elizabeth, was also in Britain as a van driver. My mind was blown. And there was a man in the archive that I ended up getting talking to. I think we both left at the same time or went for lunch at the same time. And I was telling him about the book and how great it was. And I was saying, it's a shame though, because I'm not going to include it in my dissertation because I'm looking at post-war migration. And he said, oh, that's a shame because, you know, you seem to be really enjoying it. You've not put it down all day. And I thought, you know what, you're actually right. However, I still decided that it wouldn't be something I would be writing about because I decided I'm going to be looking at post-war migration. Anyway, March 2020 came around, COVID-19 came around, lockdown came around, and I hope you know where the story is going. The archives shut, the library shut, and I had all the notes on Ben Bousquet and Colin Douglas's West Indian Women at War. And so what did I write about West Indian Women at War? I moved my dates backwards to 1939 from 1948, where they originally were. And I looked at the migration during World War II and women migrating, not only in the healthcare service and in teaching, which was my original focus, but also in the armed forces. Armed force, is that the right term for them? In the services, they were service women, ex-service women. I don't know if the ATS would be defined as an armed force. I might be overthinking that. Anyway, if it wasn't for that book, me stumbling upon it at the BCA, I would not have found it. I would not have probably been able to finish my master's dissertation when I did, because everything shut down and I had to use what I had. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I love now reading about military history. As you are aware, there's been so many episodes on this podcast about either the West Indian Regiment. I think there's episodes on the race riots, which include some of the seamen that were part of World War One from the Caribbean and from Africa. There have been episodes on the Women's Auxiliary Territorial Service. I've done episodes on my master's research. And we will be adding to this conversation of the Caribbean and the military presence in this live show that will be coming up in October. Now, one of my favourite things about the text, and I was telling Colin this the other day, actually, is the fact that he goes so far back. You know, for a book about the Second World War, I didn't think we would be reading about the 17th and 18th century Caribbean, but I'm really happy to say we are, because the military history and the military kind of presence in the Caribbean, in not just the British West Indies, this book spans, it goes through the Dutch West Indies, is that the right term? The Dutch Caribbean, the French Caribbean in part as well, and really thinks about, you know, why and how we get to a point in World War II where so many Caribbean people are so willing to be part of the war effort. So many Caribbean governments are so willing to financially give to the war effort, even the ones that aren't necessarily within the British Caribbean, and how much they actually, you know, identify with being within military roles, being within service, because of the long-standing histories of this presence. The last section of Colin's text was quite poignant to me, because it thinks about post-war Britain and this kind of idea of rebuilding, and the way that Caribbean people once again come to Britain's aid in rebuilding the country. And, you know, it details the migrations, it looks at the Almanzora, the Windrush, and the numbers of people that are arriving in the 40s, 50s, 60s. And then he kind of gives a little brief section where he talks about, and I quote, the public mood had turned sour. And he details things like the 1958 London Notting Hill riots, and then the Immigration Acts of 1962 that kind of begin to curb immigration, the Commonwealth Immigrants Act. And then he kind of forwards to the Windrush scandal, what I like to call the Home Office scandal, because it was their scandal, not the Windrushes. And he ends with the sentence, this was a continuation, this being the Windrush scandal, this was a continuation of the British Caribbean experience, fighting with Britain during global wars and during times of peace, fighting British authorities for justice. And if that didn't speak to the experience of Caribbean people, and the relationship with Britain, then I don't know what would. Fighting with Britain during global wars and during times of peace, fighting British authorities for justice. Now, my fourth book is a little bit more contemporary in terms of its content, and it's a book by Kevin Morofsky called Black Women Always, Conversations on Life, Culture and Creativity. And the book is beautiful. I will say it's a really vibrant orange colour, and you don't necessarily, or you apparently shouldn't judge a book by its cover. But if I was to judge this book by its cover, it would get a 10 out of 10. It's really beautiful, and I believe it's Kevin's own photography on the front cover of a time that's really important to him that he details in the introduction of the text, and goes on to talk about in some of his conversations with the contributors, them being Black women, of course. My favourite section is 19, which is on discipline, by Marwa the Amazing, and it's titled, You're Going to Have to Work for It, and it is exactly what it says on the tin in that regard. It's all about discipline, it's all about kind of working hard, not necessarily glamorising that and suggesting that it's going to be easy, but kind of explaining that you just have to do it sometimes. And the book itself is full of so many inspirational Black women that we see, I think, within the public eye today, you know, we would see and label as successful people today, the likes of Candice Brathwaite, Tolly T, and Audrey from the Receipts podcast, Aja Barber, Jamelia. I feel like Jamelia is like of my childhood and present, because she so heavily featured her music in the past, and she's also from Birmingham, so shout out to Birmingham. But also in the present, I see her, I always see her on TikTok, which feels strange to say because she has had this like superstar career, and now I see her on TikTok in her daughter's videos, which is always really funny to me, that people continue living lives beyond the kind of superstar pop star life. There's chapters that I've not yet read, but I'm looking forward to. A section with Julie Adenuga, Dame Elizabeth Anionwu, Lady Phil, Kelechi Okafor, Perry Shake Strayton, and Bianca Saunders as athletes. I'm really looking forward to getting into those sections as well. I'm not reading it chronologically, and I think I probably should. Sorry, Mr. Morosky, if that was the way it was intended, but chapters are just speaking to me, and I'm kind of keeping it on my bedside and picking up a chapter when I feel like I need it. And that is how I'm taking in Black Women always. It's a beautiful book. It really is. It feels like a celebration of Black womanhood, of sisterhood, being Black in Britain. And it is really encompassing some of the beautiful things that comes with that, as well as the more difficult sides of that too. They're not glossed over, not at all. Now, for the fifth and final book, The Dystopian. It's called The Treatment. It's by Sarah Moorhead, and I stress that because there are, I think, whenever I Google The Treatment, there's like three other books that come up, and a TV series, and I'm sure a film, and a band. It's a really good title, it makes sense, but maybe they could have thought about all the other things that are also called The Treatment before naming it The Treatment. But essentially, it's defined genre-wise as a thriller. I cannot lie to you, I think this might be the third thriller I've ever read in my life. I like a bit of Stephen King. Growing up, I read his books a lot, and the kind of dystopian elements of that. And there was that time, I feel like there was a time in like young adult fiction where dystopian texts were just huge, like things like the Divergent series, of course The Hunger Games. I was reading a book called, I can't remember what, the first one was called Uglies, and then it was Pretties and Specials. And I've just seen, I think Netflix have like released a film, Uglies, which I'm excited to watch as well, because I really did enjoy that dystopian genre. And then I don't know why, it just kind of fell to the wayside for me, and I stopped reading dystopian fiction. But The Treatment, right, it's all about the criminal justice system. The world is not as it is today. I mean, it is for the most part, but the way that technology has advanced, especially with our understanding of psychological issues, is developed like a 1,000,000%. And so one of the things that the government are trying to do is fight crime, and make society like a quote unquote better place and a safer place. One of the things that they did actually is banning alcohol. It's not really a spoiler. And it's interesting that alcohol is something that is removed from a society to make it safer. I thought that was quite an interesting touch. It wasn't touched on much. It was just kind of a throwaway comment, but it made me think. So with the new criminal justice system, criminals or people that commit crimes go first to tier one, which is a place for low risk crimes, where physical therapy is encouraged. Tier two is, and tier one is for things like where they can find a reason. So if you were hungry and you stole, stealing is the crime, but there was a reason you were hungry, you know, you stole to provide for your children, or you stole for shelter, or you squatted in a building because you needed somewhere to stay. Those kinds of things. And they go to this kind of like, I don't want to say too much, actually, let me not spoil the text. Tier two is where there's a psychological reason, not like a kind of material reason, for the offence, and that's examined, and then a cure is tried. They try and find a cure for you. Tier three, they use aversion therapy, and aversion therapy is essentially Oh, I feel like I'm saying too much. I don't know. Maybe I won't say it. Tier 4 is known as Siberia, and it says where all hope is lost. This is in like the Amazon, you know, bookseller synopsis. So I'm not saying anything that's not written, but I want to say more, to tell you more about this book because it's really good. I'm also reading it as part of a book club, which is part of the excitement because I always know I'm going to discuss it. So it kind of feels like uni, like undergrad, where we'd go to a seminar and discuss the book. Except for now, I don't have to write an essay and I don't have to like make the analysis good. I can just say things. Shout out to the book club, who just have to deal with me saying things. But tier 3 is the kind of controversial tier, because it's where essentially, as someone that commits a crime, they haven't found a psychological reason, there was no material reason, they just decide that, you know, you've done it for a lapse of morality because you're evil, whatever else. And you have to essentially go through what you did to somebody else. And there's a whole lot of controversy about that, because they're like, you know, isn't eye for an eye the best way to make society safer? Some people are saying it's too harsh, it's unethical, and some people are saying it's not harsh enough. Life in prison or the death penalty would be better. So there's all these kind of moral debates going on about how to deal with criminality in terms of making society safer. But there's just this like really dark underlying element to it that I obviously haven't got to the point yet because I haven't finished the text. But I really wanted to shout out this book. It's got really mixed reviews, which surprises me. And maybe when I get to the end, I won't be surprised anymore. I love also giving a review, if you haven't noticed, when I haven't finished the book yet. I would say different things if I had finished the book. But it's just sometimes quite interesting to track your thoughts about something you're reading midway through. And that is what this episode has been. So you have 5 texts there. 4 that are, well, 3 that are kind of well-rooted in history. 1 that it's a little bit more contemporary, but I think historically will stand as a text that really captures the moment of where we are for Black women. And then you have a futuristic dystopian, questions of the criminal justice system and making society a better place in Sarah Moorhead's The Treatment. So yes, they are this week's 5 books. I say this week, I'm obviously not going to read them in a week. I'm good, but I'm not that good. I hope you have enjoyed this episode. If you want any more information, book titles, they'll all be in the show notes. But I hope you do have a wonderful week, and I will see you next week for the next episode. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye.